Ukraine's president tells the group of 20 leaders Russia's destructive war can and must be stopped.
І усіх споживачів енергії у світі, передбачуваності і стабільності цін, відповіддю на це має бути примусове обмеження експортних цін для Росії.
Plus, will Republican control of the House of Representatives endanger U.S. aid to Ukraine?
Party line votes are just not going to work this time around.
And later in the program, partnering journalists with lawyers to document evidence of Russian war crimes in Ukraine. Today is Tuesday, November 15th, 2022. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Herman. World leaders gathered in Bali, Indonesia, are poised to issue a declaration stating most of the group of 20 leaders strongly condemn the war in Ukraine. A draft of the document, expected to be issued Wednesday and seen by VOA News, declares the use or threat of nuclear weapons is inadmissible. It also says the peaceful resolution of conflicts, efforts to address crises, as well as diplomacy and dialogue are vital. Today's era must not be of war. The document, whose final wording could change, also notes most G20 members strongly condemn the war in Ukraine and have stressed it is causing immense human suffering and exacerbating existing fragilities in the global economy, constraining growth, increasing inflation, disrupting supply chains, heightening energy and food insecurity, and elevating financial stability risks. Speaking remotely to the G20 summit in Bali, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky told world leaders he is convinced now is the time when Russia's destructive war must and can be stopped. He also said if Russia is trying to deprive Ukraine, Europe, and all energy consumers in the world of predictability and price stability, the answer to this should be a forced limitation of export prices for Russia. Russian President Vladimir Putin is not in attendance in Bali, essentially making the meeting the G19. But his foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, was there. Lavrov listened to Zelensky's speech and expressed displeasure. Lavrov said, "I made only one conclusion from his speech, that he does not yet listen to any Western advice. I won't list everything he said. It was militant rhetoric, Russophobic and aggressive." Following Zelensky's speech, explosions were heard in Kyiv. Residential buildings were damaged, and there is at least one fatality, according to the city's mayor. Several other Ukrainian cities also came under attack, where energy-producing facilities were damaged. Ukrainian military officials say more than 100 missiles were fired by Russia. National Grid operator Ukrenergo indicates the worst damage is in the northern and central regions, and emergency power outages for all categories of consumers have been introduced in those areas. It also announced special emergency outages in Kyiv. A Ukrainian presidential staff member says the missile attacks are Russia's response to Zelensky's G20 speech. Andrei Yermak on Twitter called the fresh attacks a demonstration that the Kremlin does not want peace, but obedience. Yermak adding, "But at the end of the day, terrorists always lose." The renewed Russian airstrikes on Ukrainian cities come a day after the United Nations General Assembly adopted a resolution calling for Moscow to pay war reparations to Kyiv. Ukrainian forces are continuing to work to stabilize recently liberated territory in and around Kherson, totaling nearly 5,000 square kilometers. As Anna Chernikova reports from Kyiv, Russian forces, which retreated from the region, are thought to be relocating along the eastern front line.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky told reporters in Kherson the situation in the recently recaptured areas of the region is similar to what he witnessed in the Kyiv and Kharkiv regions after their liberation. Ukrainian officials confirm the discovery of bodies of both soldiers and civilians, and also mass graves. They also report finding torture rooms. The infrastructure of the whole region is heavily damaged. Ukrainian officials confirm that Russian troops in the Kherson region have advanced 15 to 20 kilometers from the established lines on the left bank of the Dnieper River. Meanwhile, the city of Kherson remains on alert for shelling by Russian forces. The Institute for the Study of War, a Washington think tank, says Russian forces that retreated from the Kherson region are likely to be relocated to the Eastern Front as heavy fighting there continues and Russian forces battle for control of the city of Bakhmut. Anna Chernikova for VOA News, Kyiv.
Some Republican members of the U.S. House of Representatives are calling for funding to Ukraine to be limited or ended. Back in May, 57 Republicans in the House voted against a new $40 billion aid package for Ukraine, but the legislation passed anyway with 368 bipartisan votes. The Republicans may be poised to take control of key committees in the House. Here to discuss this is Kevin Kosar, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a prominent analyst of all things involving the U.S. Congress. Kevin, welcome to Flashpoint Ukraine.
Steve, thank you for having me on the show.
It's not official yet, but it's increasingly looking like the Republicans will wrest control from the Democrats in the House as votes continue to be counted in the November 8th midterm election. Are those voices seeking to cut U.S. financial assistance to Ukraine going to have more clout after this election?
It's not clear to me because Kevin McCarthy, who apparently will be the Speaker of the House, has previously walked back comments that Republicans were looking to pull the plug on aid to Ukraine and has qualified it and instead said, you know, we're looking to just have a bit more oversight of it. Moreover, his margin is so narrow that pretty much any piece of legislation that's going to get through the chamber is going to have to draw upon significant Democratic support. Party line votes are just not going to work this time around. So, yes, it was an interesting development when Republicans voted against the previous aid package, but this time around, if they were to do so, they would, so to speak, be playing with live ammo because it could have real consequences. And we know members of Congress frequently cast symbolic votes, but when it comes to a real vote, they change their minds.
Yeah, that's a very good point. President Joe Biden, a Democrat, has been a strong advocate of providing military aid to Ukraine. Although he has said Kyiv does not have a blank check, if he finds a congressional roadblock to what he wants to provide to Ukraine, does he have any detours around a Republican-controlled House, say through executive order powers?
Interesting question. Well, as we saw during the Trump administration, presidents sometimes do try to reprogram funds that are appropriated for other purposes. And conceivably, President could do that, and with the Senate in the hands of Democrats, would be insulated from that sort of, from any sort of backlash. So that could happen that way. But it may not come to that because I would think that any additional funding for Ukraine is going to be part of a larger package. And it's going to be part of a larger package negotiated by the president with the Democrat-controlled Senate and then presented to the House. And they will either have to take it or leave it. And if they vote against it, presumably the consequences will be significant. Perhaps it'll be part of a package to fund the government as a whole. Perhaps it'll be part of something else. And so they wouldn't be voting simply on this topic up or down, but they would have to vote against a whole lot of other stuff and then bear the brunt of public backlash.
With the two different chambers split, obviously, in normal times, there would be much more negotiations that would involve the true spirit of compromise. In this very politically polarized era, and we have a presidential election coming up in a couple of years now, what do you foresee as far as cooperation on working on these types of foreign spending bills?
On the one hand, certainly, narrow margins, divided control, and a president who does not have high public approval would seem to lead to a lot of gridlock. On the other hand, I think there are also going to be some strong incentives to try to find win-win paths, because the path of mutual aggression between the two parties is going to lead to immense collective costs on them. Nobody really wins by Congress failing to keep the government open, for example, failing to support allies like Ukraine, failing to just address public concerns. The narrow margins, I think, you know, could lead to certain cross-partisan opportunities. The real trick is to be able to structure the votes in such a way that neither party feels like they are betraying their base. And that's where wrapping things into omnibus packages and using unusual or unorthodox lawmaking techniques, passing legislation by only voting upon a rule in the House. That's how we raised the debt limit last time around. So tricks like that might be deployed in order to keep the trains running.
Kevin Kosar, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, will probably be talking to you about this again as the train rolls down the tracks next year. Thank you for your insight today on Flashpoint Ukraine.
Thank you.
The first commercial space war. That is how some are describing the conflict resulting from Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Commercial satellites are tracking Russian military movements. They're also connecting Ukrainian troops on the battlefield and collecting evidence for anticipated war crimes trials. Moscow is noticing. A senior Russian foreign military official recently warned commercial satellites may become a legitimate target for retaliation. Joining us now on Flashpoint Ukraine to discuss this is Caitlin Johnson. She is Deputy Director of the Aerospace Security Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies here in Washington. Caitlin, thank you for joining us today on the program.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, how did commercial space satellites come to play a prominent role in warfare?
Sure. So commercial space satellites have been used to support the U.S. military, for example, in space communications for decades. This time in Ukraine, we're seeing actual attacks on commercial satellites and specifically on new and innovative commercial capability in space, not our usual sat phone type of communications, but as we've seen with SpaceX's Starlink constellation, internet from space.
How does a country such as the United States or companies which own these satellites defend against any threat that Russia or another country would make to attack these satellites in space?
So there are a lot of ways to defend your satellites. You can make them more resilient by building in protections to harden these systems, make them harder to, let's say, hack if you were doing a cyber attack, or, you know, have different types of constellations in orbit that make these capabilities more resilient. What we're seeing in Ukraine from Russia is a localized attack on satellites. So they're not actually damaging the satellites in space. They're really just damaging the data that the satellite and the communication from the ground to the satellite and back. So it's very localized to just the region of conflict.
But there are weapons out there or being developed that could directly attack satellites from Earth or from space, right?
Sure. The most probably common when people hear the word anti-satellite or ASAT weapon is actually a missile launched from Earth that intercepts or detonates near a satellite on orbit and physically destroys it. And we've seen a couple countries test this, but most recently we saw Russia test this capability successfully in low Earth orbit in November 2021. So before the conflict started, probably as a posturing maneuver from Russia to show that they could hold commercial or military satellites at risk. But that debris that was created from that attack is lingering in low Earth orbit and actually has caused the International Space Station and many other satellites to move several times.
Aren't there international treaties that are supposed to prohibit these sort of attacks?
Yes. So space is often referred to as like the new Wild West. There are a couple of international laws regulating the space domain, but they're pretty vague. They were mostly written in the 60s and 70s. Think about what we can do now that we weren't doing in the 60s. And so these treaties are extremely outdated for the capability and the amount of countries and companies that can use space today. But there is a line in the Outer Space Treaty, which is kind of the foundational document for international relations in space, saying that space must be used for peaceful purposes. And clearly, you know, it is the opinion of many that attacking satellites in space is not a peaceful purpose.
Now, the White House has reacted publicly to the Russian threat, stating any attack on U.S. infrastructure, as they put it, will be met with a response in a time and manner of our choosing. That sounds paradoxically firm but vague. Help us unwrap that. How do you expect the U.S. government would respond if the Russians did something like this?
The reason that they take that phrase and the, you know, the place of our choosing at the time of our choosing is really because the United States space capabilities are so robust and we are so dependent on space for our modern military, our modern economy and way of life that other countries who might be attacking us, that aggression might not have the same space dependency that we do. So it might not make sense to respond in kind in space, to do kind of a tit for tat in space, but it might make more sense to respond in other ways, maybe attacking the systems on the ground that are actually denying our access to these space capabilities. So that's not exactly the same type of attack, but it would have a similar effect in conflict.
Caitlin Johnson, Deputy Director and Fellow at the Aerospace Security Project, run by the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thank you for your analysis here on VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine.
Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Herman. Russia's disinformation and propaganda campaigns in pursuit of conquering Ukraine are being compared to tactics Nazi Germany used to demonize Jews and other minorities in its campaign of violence and extermination. Peter Pomerantsev, a Ukrainian-born British journalist and author, is co-founder and co-director of The Reckoning Project, which is partnering journalists with lawyers to document evidence for war crimes cases. In an interview with Tatiana Vorosko, the supervisory managing editor of VOA's Ukrainian service, he was asked how much collective responsibility ordinary Russians are going to carry for the war.
75 years after the Second World War, we are still debating whether Germans, ordinary Germans, at that time, bear responsibility with the Holocaust. So these sort of debates about collective responsibility, they seem endless. They go on and on and on and on. What I do know is that on a very personal level, the Russians that I know who have taken a political position, they do feel responsible. They feel deeply responsible and deeply ashamed. They also feel impotent, and we can talk about that sense of impotence, but they do feel deeply responsible. While the ones who have stayed will always shrug off responsibility. One of the coping mechanisms people have is to say, "Я тут ни при чем. It's a dictatorship. I've got nothing to do with this." The people who feel responsibility are also the ones who want to do something active. They don't always know how to. They don't always can. They haven't found a way to do it, frankly, but at least they think about it. So I wonder whether responsibility is deeply connected with the sense of having a self. To say that I have responsibility is to have quite a high regard for yourself. Guilt and responsibility are deeply connected to a sense of agency. So I think it's actually almost a symptom of the way people have been crushed or agreed to have been crushed by the system in Russia that they refuse to take on responsibility. Yeah, it's deeply connected. The collective responsibility question is one that is sort of like, it hasn't been resolved around Germany for 70 years.
But it's not only the sense of responsibility, but also Ukrainians kind of shocked is the lack of empathy.
I'm surprised by the surprise. So Vladimir Putin was elected in 2000 on the back of a murderous war against in Chechnya, which whatever you may think of the background and the reasons for it was based upon the principle of bombing civilians. He had success in Syria by massively destroying civilian populations. This is the Russian way of war. This is not a society that holds any kind of worth to human life. I don't see why people are surprised. I lived in Russia for 9 years between 2001 and 2010. It's an utterly callous society.
We know the example of Rwanda. They were high-level executives which were brought to justice. They had hefty prison terms or even life terms. Is something possible in the case with Russia?
There is some track record of propagandists being found guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity. I don't think the Rwandan example is a very useful one. Rwanda, literally, you have people saying, go to this church and make sure more people die. It's a direct instruction. That very rarely happens. Interesting looking at the case of Nuremberg and the Nazis. One of the chief propagandists is found guilty, Julius Streicher. He's the editor of the most anti-Semitic magazine, but he's also the Gauleiter of Nuremberg. He's also a Nazi decision maker. He's found guilty, both for incitement, but also because he was part of the inner organization of the party. Hans Fritzsche, head of the Reichsradio, on air every evening, giving anti-Semitic speeches, found not guilty. Very, very quickly found not guilty. One of the quickest cases. Because the argument is he's given a piece of paper and he reads it. Who the hell is he? That is interesting, because what you have to show is that the propagandists are aware that they are part of military operations that commit war crimes or domestic operations that lead to arrests and murder inside of Russia. You have to show they're aware of it, that they're part of the system, that they have a choice. So those are things you'd have to show. I think they're perfectly showable. I think that anybody working in the Russian media post February 24th has to be aware that what they're doing is part of an integrated military operation leading to war crimes, crimes against humanity, war of aggression, perhaps intent to genocide. There's just no way you're not aware of it anymore. People have left because they don't want to be part of it. It's not just words. Genocidal rhetoric is not the same as intent to genocide. Words are not enough. You'd have to show that the words are part of a system that prepares military operations. So the example that's often used, we would want to look at a case study like the bombing of the hospital in Mariupol. For weeks before that, there's Russian propaganda saying there are Nazi Ukrainian fighters in this hospital. Disinformation leading to the enabling of a war crime. Simply saying nasty things is not criminal. So you'd have to show that they are part of a machine. But they are part of a machine. We know they're part of a machine. We know that the Russian media is integrated into state mechanisms. And I think you'd start with showing domestic repressions as well. You'd show how the media is used to go after opponents of the government inside Russia, how that leads to their arrests, how that leads to their beatings, sometimes their murder. They will, of course, say, we had no idea. We just say things. We're just given pieces of paper to read, or we are just giving opinion. You'd have to show it's more than opinion. I think that's easier today than it was during the Nazi times, because now you can show how something starts as words on TV, becomes an online coordinated campaign that leads up to a military operation. I think you can show the system in much more granularity than you used to. I think there is a chance. I'm not a lawyer, but I have spoken to lawyers who think there is a reasonable case to be made.
That's Peter Pomerantsev of The Reckoning Project. That's all for today's program. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And on our social media platforms, you can follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Chief National Correspondent, Steve Herman. Good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.